Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments up today. First, in a doubleheader unusual for Behind the News, we'll talk with two experts on Korea, Christine Ahn and Tim Shorrock, about the transition in North Korea, and the preposterous interpretations of that country that are routine even among the supposedly alternative media in the U.S. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Aaron Beatty, who blogs as Zungu Zungu, a name he'll explain about 12 minutes into the interview, about the meanings of Occupy Oakland. Before that, just a few words in the news, seasonally adjusted. Over the summer, in despair over the political situation, I asked about 25 writers I like and admire to answer the question, why effing bother? I'd gone so far as to set up a website to post the responses. Here we were, stuck in the midst of the worst economic crisis in 80 years, but without any of the energetic political response we saw in the 1930s. There were no communists organizing rent strikes, and the bourgeoisie was unable to produce a figure like FDR. Instead, we had the teabaggers, right-wing nutters who now look to be on the wane, and Obama, who pronounced Lloyd Blankfein and Jamie Dimon to be savvy businessmen, who deserve their combined $26 million in bonuses they claimed in 2009, just after they'd been bailed out by the U.S. government. At the time of Obama's election, I'd hoped that disappointment with all the hopes invested in him back in 2008 might yield a radical turn among a sizable chunk of the population. It was a long time coming. But finally, after a long delay, optimal disillusionment finally kicked in. On September 17th, a small crowd gathered in Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan, and 3 months later, political discourse in the U.S. has been changed remarkably. That gathering did what those of us who've been nattering for years about inequality and the malign power of finance couldn't do. Suddenly, there seemed a good reason to bother. And it continues. So here's to more of it in 2012. Back after a musical break. Some of Béla Bartók's Romanian Christmas songs performed by Yeno Yondo. The death of Kim Jong-il brought forth some weird commentary in our press, little of it very enlightening. For better insights into what's going on, here are Christine Ahn, Executive Director of the Korea Policy Institute in Los Angeles, and Tim Shorrock, a Washington-based journalist who's been covering both Koreas for a long time and even spent a good bit of his early years living there. Christine Ahn and Tim Shorrock. Welcome to both of you. I noticed in the Tuesday Financial Times this stunning headline, Tyrant developed nuclear arms as people starved. I think that's a succinct expression of the Western view of North Korea and the reign of Kim Jong-il. Christine Ahn, you've been there. What do you think of that evaluation?
I think it's a very simplistic and ignorant analysis, frankly. Kim Jong-il came into power in 1994 when his father passed away, Kim Il-sung, and he was handed a very difficult and complicated situation. One was Kim Il-sung had just negotiated the agreed framework with the Clinton administration, which essentially, thanks to the work of Jimmy Carter and many Korean Americans that urged him on to essentially go to North Korea with the CNN camera crew and agreed to stop its nuclear program. And in exchange for that, the U.S. had agreed to a set of conditions such as the light water reactors, fuel. We were essentially on the brink of war with North Korea in 1994. That means the U.S. And with the passing of Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il had to deal with the nuclear crisis. He also had to deal with the collapse of the socialist trading bloc, which really devastated its economy and impacted its ability to import fuel and energy, which literally, you know, impacted their ability to operate their tractors and their food production system, which had been centralized and distributed throughout the country. He had dealt with internal major shocks to its climate, massive droughts and flooding that just further compounded the matter. And so, yes, it's unfortunate. It's tragic. It's actually devastating that up to 1 million people, North Koreans, died in that famine. But I think it's very simplistic to just say it's the evil dictator that starved its people. It's actually a combination of all those factors. And the fact that, you know, what North Koreans will say to me is the ongoing sanctions against that country and its inability to recalibrate its economy because of various roadblocks put forth by the United States and Western nations against it. I think what has been a lifeline to North Korea has been China. And to wrap up that, you know, I think it's a very simplistic and ignorant way to frame how North Koreans have been suffering from food shortages and an energy crisis.
Well, we're working in a cartoon mode. Another cartoon, of course, is that North Koreans are a bunch of robots who subsist on bugs. What did you see in your visits there?
That, again, is just, I guess, adding to the whole propaganda that surrounds North Korea and the vilification of its leaders and its people. What I saw were people that were very hardworking, who were very resourceful in terms of making ends meet with very little resources. I saw, you know, the country going through incredible hardship. And this is even in Pyongyang. I mean, I was able to travel pretty extensively throughout the country, so I could see how especially the rural parts suffered, but so did the people in Pyongyang. I mean, you saw people in the dead of winter. I went once in February, and, you know, people waiting in long lines for buses, you know, in like almost 15-degree Fahrenheit. And, you know, you can see at nighttime it's just pitch black because everybody's trying to conserve energy. So I saw people just, you know, having a very difficult life on a day-to-day basis. But what I also learned that I think most Americans don't quite understand is a deep sense and need for North Koreans to have independence and sovereignty. And I think that's where Kim Jong-il had a very mixed legacy, because he wasn't able to deliver in terms of providing, in terms of recalibrating the economy and improving their day-to-day lives. But what he did succeed in was in obtaining a nuclear weapon, which they view as very pivotal in ensuring that North Korea remains a sovereign nation. And so, yeah, I spoke at length to people about how they viewed the role of the U.S. military, or as they would call us, imperialists, and how they view the Americans as a continuation of the Japanese colonizers that had essentially occupied that country for 35 years. And so I met people that were frankly very politicized and very revolutionary in their thinking. And so it's a very unique country. There, I think, you know, contrary to what most people think, I think that we have a lot to learn from the people there in terms of their thinking collectively, in terms of thinking about the greater good, the public good. And hopefully through engagement and dialogue, we will have that opportunity.
That's the voice of Christine Ahn. And Tim Schrock, you're in Washington. What is Washington's view of the transition of power? Nothing, little or nothing is known about the new ruler of North Korea. How is Washington viewing this moment?
Washington's a pretty big word there. I would say that there's several tendencies. There's one pushed by certain people on the right who think that we're saying things like, you know, North Korea is about to implode any day now, and that, you know, Kim Jong, this new son who's apparently been named a successor, will not last long, and the country's about to collapse, and therefore the United States should do whatever it can to push that collapse on. You know, there's this editorial in the New York Times today by Victor Cha, who's been all over the media, who used to work for the Bush administration, and he's saying that, you know, that the collapse could come soon, and that therefore, you know, China and the U.S. should work to, you know, basically, you know, regime change in North Korea. So you have that, and you, and those, some of those people on the right are advising some of our Republican candidates, and I think they would like nothing better than to have some kind of, you know, toppling of the regime there. I'm not sure what their long-term plan is, but that's one part, one faction, perhaps. And I think the Obama administration has been holding negotiations. You have just before Kim Jong-il died, in fact, last week, there was negotiations going on in Beijing where they were talking about expanding, or, you know, for the first time in many years, extending food aid from the U.S. to North Korea. In exchange, North Korea will stop its uranium enrichment program, and those would be seen as steps toward reopening these six-party talks aimed at ending the nuclear confrontation that Christine talked about that goes back to the mid-90s. So I think there's, you know, different perspectives here in Washington, and I think that the press in general, the media from the left to the right to the mainstream, is completely clueless, totally out to lunch about knowing nothing about North Korea. And it's very, very obvious to me that when we talk isolation, we're pretty isolated here in Washington. Diplomats in China, people in Japan have far more knowledge and understanding of what's going on in North Korea than anybody does here.
And when we were talking earlier, you mentioned something about a pipeline that could change things dramatically. What's that about?
Well, for years there's been talk of having a pipeline coming from, you know, Russian oil fields in the Siberia part of Russia, in the eastern part of Russia, that would go through North Korea and South Korea into a port in South Korea, which would, and then it could be unloaded there in a port in the south. And this would be a way for North Korea to earn foreign exchange in another way besides, you know, selling weapons or other kinds of machinery that it makes, and be able to get some foreign revenue and be able to share in, you know, economic growth with South Korea. It would require a lot of, you know, diplomatic and economic agreements to allow that to happen. But those negotiations are pretty far along. And I think that's the kind of project that can help North Korea maintain some kind of income and try to raise the level of, you know, the standard of living for its people. I think there's some real possibilities that could happen.
It's the voice of Tim Shorrock, a longtime journalist who's been covering South Korea for many years, probably more years than either of us cares to count. I was kind of shocked by the cheap jokes that even fairly progressive and sophisticated people make about Kim Jong-il and North Korea. I mean, do either of you have a reaction to that?
I think it's absolutely shameful. Yeah, it's real funny, real hip to make jokes about Kim Jong-il and about his bouffant haircut. You know, but the thing is, one thing a lot of people don't know is that a lot of Koreans, men in the South too, have their hair like that. It's nothing different. There's a lot of racism behind this. And I think people would love to make snark and make, you know, ugly comments like that rather than really look at the reality of the situation. And I think you find that, you know, frankly, you know, you find a lot of that on the left, because a lot of people in the left press, from Mother Jones to any other publication, they have no, like I said, have no clue what's going on there. And all they can do is, you know, make up these things. Nobody's doing any real reporting. They don't even talk to Koreans. It's like they don't exist.
Christine?
Yeah, I think Tim just nailed it. I was actually going to bring up the example of Mother Jones. I remember around the time that the Axis of Evil speech came out, Mother Jones had this chart where they were comparing Kim Jong-il to Little Kim. And, you know, just reiterating what Bush had, the term that Bush had used to describe Kim Jong-il, which was as a pygmy. And I do agree with Tim. It's definitely rooted in racism. It's this kind of orientalism about this yellow peril that is so embedded in the history of this country. You know, what's so shameful that progressives kind of perpetuate these really racist and ugly stereotypes is that there is almost a cluelessness and ignorance about what the devastating impact that this country and this government and this military has had on the psyche or even the lives of Korean people, not just in the North, but also in the South. I mean, the U.S. committed some pretty atrocious massacres in South Korea as well, too. So I just think that if progressives even knew, were even attuned at all to the horrendous acts that were committed against the Korean people, a nation that, you know, was not like Germany, that was an aggressor nation, but a country that had been colonized and then divided by, you know, essentially unilaterally by the United States with, you know, a nod of agreement from the Soviet Union. But, you know, if they even recognize the kind of really horrendous history and the implication of this government on the Korean Peninsula, I think that they would be so ashamed that they would just kind of perpetuate these ugly stereotypes about North Korea and essentially their leaders. I mean, we might not approve of the kind of political system or economic system that North Korea has, but that is really their right, and certainly not an aggressor nation like ours against North Korea should have any right to dictate how we're going to influence or shape that country. What we need to do is ensure that our political leaders clean up our act and begin the process of dialogue, because it has been over 60-plus years that the war has literally continued on and still is the underlying factor that affects the human rights of the people of North Korea, that is impacting the ongoing militarization of both North and South Korea, and therefore the justification of repressing the people on both sides of the DMZ, and also the instability and the militarization of the entire Northeast Asian region.
I would also add, Doug, that you know, Christine talked about, you know, the Korean War and the terrible things that happened during that war. But, you know, a lot of people don't know that, you know, until the late 70s, North Korea, its economy was very well developed. There was a CIA report in 1976, I think it was, that said in all indices, steel, coal, you know, all the basic industrial indices, North Korea was ahead of South Korea as, you know, as more recently as like 1976. And they had developed their economy, you know, after the complete destruction of the country by United States bombing. And with actually, you know, not that much, they had lots of good trading agreements with the Chinese and with the Soviet Union, but they did a lot of this, you know, they developed their own industries. They didn't become dependent on the socialist world market, and they were criticized a lot within the Soviet Union for that.
They had a doctrine of self-reliance, right? What was that called?
Yes, they called it, you know, Juche self-reliance, and there really is something to that, and they did develop, you know, quite a sophisticated technology in lots of areas. And then, you know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, like happened to Cuba and other countries that stayed, you know, socialist, they just lost, you know, all that, those relationships, and in the case of North Korea, they lost very inexpensive oil they were getting from the Soviets, and then natural calamities and also just the over-centralization really damaged the economy, and it went downhill through the 80s and 90s until today. It's just, you know, barely sputtering along, and lots of, you know, factories have just been completely taken apart and disassembled and pieces of them sold. And so it's really the economic situation there is quite desperate, but there is, you know, there's pockets of high technology. You know, there's exchanges between North and South Korea where there's this Kaesong industrial zone where Korean companies go and they're trying to pass on technology to North Korea to develop some kind of manufacturing, and, you know, and it's, you know, they're allowing private investors in certain areas and trying to learn from China. They have a whole lot, a long way to go. But they do have this history of an economy, of, you know, a fairly sound economy. And I think a lot of people, you know, in these characterizations of North Korea as evil and crazy, misses a lot of that history. And the problem with that kind of characterization is it dehumanizes them. Are constantly correcting people that say they're not crazy there. You know, people act out of, like, for example, in the 1994 agreement, you know, the sort of standard line here is that North Korea, you can't trust them because they just don't keep treaty, they don't keep agreements. Well, that nuclear agreement was signed by President Clinton and the North Korean leader Kim Il-sung, and 1994 is when it was signed. If you people remember, 1994 is when Gingrich took over the Republican Congress, and they immediately began attacking Clinton for being an appeaser, for signing this agreement, and the U.S. actually unilaterally withdrew from a lot of aspects of the agreement. And the North Koreans saw the U.S. breaking the agreement and said, well, okay, we're going to, if they do that, they're not going to do this, so we're not going to do this. And the thing, you know, unraveled in a lot of ways, but there's still essential parts of that agreement are in place. And I think that, you know, the United States knows that, and that's why they keep talking. They know there is possibilities of reaching agreements with them in some areas. And I would stress that, you know, yesterday or the day the death was announced, there was a, they tested a missile, and that missile had been, in the test had been in the works for some weeks. But the fact is, if they're going to develop missiles, they have to test them. And if we want to stop them from developing missiles that could eventually carry a warhead, we need to have negotiations to bring a complete halt to that missile program. And that missile agreement was on the table when Clinton left office and Bush came in, and Bush put the kibosh on any kind of negotiations with North Korea. So I think there are some possibilities of having, you know, a negotiated settlement of some of the issues, and then, you know, coming forward with some kind of economic plan that would allow that economy to develop a little bit.
That's the voice of Tim Sharrock. Christine, what do you think that South Koreans are making of things in this particular moment?
Yeah, I will talk about that. I also just wanted to quickly chime in. I thought Tim was going to bring in the South Korean side. And the thing that also, I mean, not to kind of go back into history, but the other thing that I think most Americans don't realize is that, you know, up until 1980, I mean, essentially South Korea was governed by dictators and in many cases either planted by the U.S. or backed by the U.S. I mean, Park Chung-hee, who ruled for 17 years, you know, was a brutal dictator, and the U.S. had backed these dictatorships for very long through the strong, you know, so-called U.S. ROK alliance. And so I think in terms of the current day, I think that it's very interesting, and perhaps the deal that was brokered over the weekend, which now looks very fragile, in light of the passing of Kim Jong-il, is that perhaps the Obama administration and the Lee administration, which is a very conservative one in South Korea, maybe they see the writing on the wall in terms of the political shifts that are taking place in South Korea. There was a mayoral election that happened in Seoul last month, and, you know, it was an upset for the Grand National Party, which is Lee Myung-bak's party, and, you know, the front runner was supposed to be this woman from that party, and in fact, you know, she was defeated by an independent candidate who is considered, his name is Park Won-sun, and he's considered the grandfather of South Korean civil society. He, you know, helped form People's Solidarity for People's Democracy. And so there is this kind of tidal wave of more liberal, progressive thinking. And, you know, really he was able to win the election because of the tremendous voting by younger people. I mean, people in their 30s, 20s, 40s. And, you know, I think that it's a sign of South Koreans being really tired of the Cold War. I imagine they are really pissed off about what happened last winter with the shelling of Yeongpyeongdo. And but I would conjecture to think that they are also not pleased with the hard line that has been coming from the Lee administration against North Korea. So I think that the Obama administration and South Korean military and political leaders recognize that there is likely to be a shift next year, 2012. There's two big elections, one in the spring and one in the fall and winter, that is the National Assembly and the presidential elections. And by all accounts, it's looking like it's going to shift to the left. And so I think between that and, you know, as much as we, I think Tim and I agree that there's not likely to be shocks throughout North Korea's political system because there is a political leadership, an elite circle that, you know, has a good handle on things in North Korea. But the fact that Kim Jong-un is young, he's not from the Cold War era, the fact that he, you know, went to school in Switzerland and has lived outside of North Korea. I think that, you know, these two things combined, I think, make a very interesting political landscape and possibility for, one, the, you know, questioning the ongoing role of U.S. military occupation in South Korea, and two, what is the future of a divided Korea, and is there a possibility for reconciliation and the gradual reunification of the two countries?
We're just about out of time, but I'm wondering, the caricature here, of course, is that it was a pure autocracy run by one lunatic man, but obviously things are much more complicated than that. What do we know about the structures and personalities that govern the country?
There's some stories have come out today, particularly in the South Korean press, and about, you know, who is who within the North Korean power structure. And I was looking through that this morning, and, you know, there's a lot of names that I recognize, you know, like the president of the Presidium, the sort of the parliament of North Korea is someone named Kim Jong-nam. He's been around. He's in his 80s. He used to be the foreign minister. But there's a lot of people like that that have been around for decades. And some of these people have been in power, in certain positions of power, and then they've been fired from their jobs, or they've left and gone back to some other kind of work and then come back into the power structure. So there is a kind of fluidity within it, but it's stayed static. The same people have been there in many cases for many years. They've tried to cultivate younger people, but there is a strong group of people there. And it doesn't mean that, you know, because they've named this guy the successor, the third son, Kim Jong-un, the successor, doesn't mean he's holding the strings of power. Kim Jong-il himself, when his father died, it took something like 4 years for the structure, the ruling structure, the party structure, to really accept him as their, you know, as the leader, as a designated leader. And he was not appointed to these high positions over the military until it took a few years. And, you know, yet it was noted by some people in the South Korean press today and yesterday that, you know, Kim Jong-un was named, you know, chair of the funeral committee, but he was not named to any senior positions, except they basically said he was a successor. So, you know, it's going to take some time to adapt, to work out, but I don't really see any signs of that power structure disintegrating. I think there's what the question now is going to be is, you know, what the people below and, you know, the rank and file of North Koreans are going to be doing and saying, because, you know, things have changed in the last 15 years. There's you know, hundreds and hundreds of cell phones that people have. There's a lot more communication with people in South Korea, with people in China. And, you know, those kinds of things have started opening up. And I think, you know, people are going to be reacting. But they're reacting also to, you know, their economic situation and their economic conditions. And I think that, you know, it's incumbent upon that ruling circle to do something about the economy going, because there's, you know, what reports you can read, there is a lot of unrest and a lot of questioning of the leadership because of, you know, what's happening, the crumbling economy. There's a steady group of people, and there really are no signs of it splintering.
Anything you'd like to add to that, Christine Ong?
No, I think that Tim's assessment is spot on, and, you know, I'm sure the people are very fatigued with the, you know, perennial food crisis and other shortages. What we can do on this end is ensure that our political leaders do what they can to ensure that, you know, that the people of North Korea have access to these basic needs for survival in order to engage in a more democratic political process.
All right, thanks to both of you. You're listening to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back with Aaron Beatty after a musical break.
We are the front of luxury. We can't abandon the story.
That was some of the Front of Luxury by the Berlin-based Rhythm King and her friends, who identify as queer electronica. My next guest is Aaron Beatty, a Berkeley grad student who blogs under the name Zungu Zungu. I do feel a little odd sometimes doing this show from the other side of the continent. Some of the material covered in this interview may be old news to Bay Area residents, but probably not all of it. And since this show has a worldwide audience, it's not going to be old news for listeners elsewhere. There's been a lot of great minute-by-minute coverage of the Occupy movement, but not so much longer-term strategic analysis as at least I would like to hear. Here's some of that from Aaron Beatty. Welcome, Aaron. I'm interested in exploring some of the things you've written about on your blog and elsewhere about differences between Occupy Oakland, Occupy Wall Street. You said that in the name Occupy Wall Street, there's a clear antagonism between the people and big finance. Occupy Oakland, the nature of the struggle is not quite so clear. So what do you see as at the core of the Occupy Oakland concept?
I would say the struggle is the same in many ways, and people understand that. But it does seem to me that Occupy Oakland has had a sort of resolutely local focus and praxis in a way that seems at least worth bringing out and thinking of in sort of contradistinction to the very broad and sometimes abstract conflict with the banks or the economy, or like that kind of rhetoric can take things away from the very local actions that have been happening in Oakland that have a lot to do with, I think, very ground level issues like homelessness. And you know, there's a kind of ground level basis to city council decisions that has struck me, and I don't know because I am very far from New York, but it struck me as being different in important ways.
Well, we do have a lot of ancillary movements in New York that have sprung up around foreclosures and around the schools, labor issues, the Sotheby's thing. So, I mean, people are also focusing locally as well as on the abstraction of the banks and Wall Street. And believe me, you know, 25 years of writing about Wall Street and the banks, I still haven't figured out exactly how to locate or name them. But the issues around Oakland, Oakland is not shaped strictly by very local things. Oakland is part of a very cosmopolitan region, a very dynamic economic region. So how local can an Oakland-focused struggle be?
Well, I mean, I think you put your finger on it. I mean, one of the things that local or is Oakland a city or is the Bay Area a city, with Oakland being a kind of subordinated unit within the Bay Area? And I think in a lot of ways the effort to occupy Oakland is an effort to in some ways extricate Oakland as a unit from a lot of the ways that the larger Bay Area has incorporated it unequally. You know, the things like the port action are very much, you know, the rhetoric around the port action and the justification for the port shutdown has a lot to do with the fact that Oakland is not a poor city if you think of it as having this gigantic economic enterprise. It's a struggle to figure out exactly what to call the port of Oakland, actually.
It's nominally owned publicly in some sense, but the money is not seen locally?
Exactly.
Where does it go?
It goes to bondholders. It goes to it gets reinvested. And, you know, and so there's two main things that happen is that when the port was modernized years ago, bondholders who are not in Oakland, they get their financialization cut off the top. But then the people who run the port for the city, because it's owned by the city. The mayor appoints a board of directors. They have a tendency to reinvest everything back into other industries in the city, other enterprises on behalf of the city, and the profits that should come back to the city have a way of never actually coming back.
I was confused from this distance about precisely what the goal of the port shutdown was. Could you share with me some of the thinking behind that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot of the media coverage has really emphasized union non-endorsement. And that's definitely part of the story. But I mean, there's both the port action as a strike on behalf of ILW workers in Longview, and in cooperation with port workers in Oakland and elsewhere. And then there's the strike as an autonomous action taken by Occupy Oakland to strike back at the city for having shut them down. It's actually worth kind of distinguishing those two things, because I think a lot of the energy from the port shutdown, a lot of the energy for that action really does come from the sense that having been attacked by the city, some kind of action has to be taken. And then at the same time, there's a very kind of complicated dance going on between Occupy Oakland and the ILWU, who are legally constrained in all sorts of ways from directly participating in the port shutdown, even to the extent of speaking out in support of it or organizing on behalf of it. There's a lot of legal restrictions I don't have to tell you about. But one of the things that can happen in this kind of situation is that when a community picket line is set up, it takes the responsibility and the burden away from the ILWU to actually have to strike. I mean, they just observe a community picket line and then the port is shut down. So it's a very kind of complicated situation that comes out of the fact that the unions are so constrained. And, you know, even a notoriously radical union like the ILWU is in a difficult situation in situations like this.
Well, they're constrained legally, but some of the leadership may not be quite so fond of radical militant action as either the rank or file or the occupiers. I mean, is that also the kind of constraint you're talking about?
Well, I mean, that's not the kind of constraint I'm talking about, but I also don't want to downplay that. I mean, I think it's, you know, you can call it a union, but it never speaks with a single voice. And so those kinds of conversations and those kinds of disagreements are sort of inevitable. But I do think that there is it's worth at least being very aware of how much union buy-in there was and how much even the non-unionized truck drivers who were in the port that day, there were certainly some truck drivers who were upset at having lost a day's wages. But I have to admit, I all of the truck drivers I actually interacted with were sort of there was a very similar kind of affect where they were sort of not fully on board with it, but completely friendly and completely. They were supportive of the idea. They were just sort of not participating. And, you know, and I think it's worth thinking about, a non-unionized truck driver in that situation, the constraints on his ability to participate, the constraints on his or her ability to speak freely about these sorts of things are so much greater than any kind of institutional way that they can speak for themselves, that it's a very difficult thing to figure out who might have the right to speak on behalf of those people. And that does apply to Occupy Oakland as well. I'm not trying to deny that. But it's been frustrating to hear the media beat the single note over and over and over again of sort of union non-participation when it's actually a really it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah, well, the media are not normally known for their sympathy to unions or strikes, but when they express sympathy for people, when there is a strike on, they often express sympathy for the innocent victims. So, you know, their tune changes. But still, there are a lot of people who are sympathetic with labor. Radical people or sympathetic labor who thought that there's a certain impatience on the part of the occupiers who are not willing to work with the unions and develop support and were sort of arrogating to themselves the right to speak for the masses when there are these institutions that, as problematic as they are, exist. And one hopes that it'd be hard to have a better society without better unions, at least from my point of view. So there are a lot of people who are just concerned that there is not enough attention paid to these niceties, and there was too much trying to happen too soon. I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, I would agree with that as a principle. I mean, I think that I'm wholly in support of what you're saying, in the sense that conversations with the union and participation with unionized workers is, to the extent that that's possible and feasible, it's crucial. That said, I mean, the first port shutdown, during the general strike, whether it was a general strike or not, that was what my understanding was, that was largely, that came out of conversations with the ILWU. You know, it wasn't even Occupy Oakland's idea exactly. And this is something I'm not exactly sure how that came down, but it was always understood by everyone that this was something that was being done in cooperation or coordination with at least ILWU members. And that's never changed. I think that it is a real danger for the Occupy movement to demand that only it has the right to speak for the 99%, is that rhetoric sometimes leads people to overreach. But there's also something to be said for, when it comes to the Port of Oakland, unionized workers and non-unionized workers at the Port of Oakland are an important part of the constituency of that port. But so is everyone else in Oakland. And so I think that it's a delicate line, and I don't want to pretend that it isn't. But I think that you don't have to tell anyone – I would say two things. You don't have to tell anyone at Occupy Oakland that they need to work with the unions. I think that people there want to do that and are doing that to the extent that they can. But the other thing is that I think it would be dangerous to make that the buy-in point. And I think the Occupy movement, in a lot of ways, that both unions and the Occupy movement benefit from not being too joined at the hip and being able to support each other but also act autonomously.
No, that's a persuasive position, I think. I'm speaking with Aaron Beatty, who's a graduate student at Berkeley and also blogs as Zungu Zungu. And by the way, what is Zungu Zungu?
I spent some time in Tanzania, and the word for white person in Tanzania is, in Swahili, is mzungu. And so when if you're walking along, children will shout mzungu at you. And sometimes it sort of merges when there's a lot of children. I was there teaching in a school, they'll yell zungu, 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 zungu. But it also just sort of, it's a kind of fun word that doesn't quite mean white in a simplistic way. It's usually taken to mean that. But it also just sort of means someone who goes around and around, and someone who's kind of, it could mean dizzy, it could mean in love, it could mean sort of disattached. And so I just kind of like the concept as maybe a nicer way to say white, which is what I
am. Well, there's also Wallace Stevens called The Pleasures of Merely Circulating. Just getting back to the port for a moment, I'm still trying to understand what the strategy was behind the shutdown. It was certainly not going to disrupt the process of accumulation in any serious way. Was it symbolic? Was it an attempt to build support? Was it an attempt to show muscle? I mean, what was the goal behind the action?
Well, I mean, part of it is to show that it could be done. And I think no one is necessarily looking for a protracted shutdown at this point. And they weren't then. I mean, the idea was to shut it down for a day, but it was an escalation in terms of coordinating with other Occupy movements along the West Coast. One of the things that is often said about the port, and I'll go back to your question in a second, but one of the things that's often said about it is, you know, if the port becomes unreliable, you know, if it keeps getting shut down, business will go elsewhere. One of the reasons why this shutdown was a coordinated shutdown with, you know, Portland, Seattle, Los Angeles, was to sort of demonstrate that shutting down Oakland, you know, that there would be a kind of solidarity between different Occupy movements, so that it wouldn't be like a localized problem, but also an escalation of the movement's ability to do that kind of coordination. And, you know, I was at the first port shutdown. I was at the first one and the second one, and the difference was really night and day. The first one was very disorganized. It was put together very quickly. It was kind of haphazard, and it was successful, but it was not well organized. The second one was just couldn't have been better organized, couldn't have gone, it went off without a hitch. And so part of, I think, expanding it as a West Coast, movement or coordination, was to kind of expand that ability to do it, to show that it could be done, and next time it would be done better if it were to be done better. I mean, the problem is that there's not a lot that Occupy can do to make people in positions of power respect us or come, you know, to have a negotiation in good faith, you know, to take the Occupy movement seriously, to treat the Occupy movement seriously, despite what they say. And so it's important that the movement, I think, is trying to find tactics that will force that kind of recognition. So, you know, I think a big part of it is just to demonstrate that it could be done, to show that the movement hasn't gone away and that the movement is capable of these sorts of things. Because until the movement finds those kinds of choke points that it can control, I think that, you know, police repression is just going to be a kind of low-level constant forever. and that's going to choke the movement to death.
Yeah, well, I like the way Fran Piven puts it, that to be successful, movements have to disrupt the everyday life and convince the elites that things are on the verge of ungovernability, which I imagine that's the thinking behind this sort of thing.
Yeah, and the idea of shutting down the port for a day is to show that this is something Boots Riley said. You know, he said, we just demonstrated that we could at will shut down the flow of commerce, or the flow of capitalism. I'm not sure how you put it, but I think that demonstration is a lot more important than the, you know, I think the city council claimed that $4 to $8 million were lost in that period. But it made them take notice. It has made the city council put forward an emergency proposal that was sort of so badly drafted and so poorly received by the community that they tabled it. But it did make them take notice in a certain kind of way, and I think that's a step towards what Fran Piven was saying about sort of normalizing ungovernability.
I was scratching my head over that resolution. I thought, you know, the cops are not brutal enough. They need to be authorized to be even more brutal. That was rather strange. Finally, did you want to say something?
Well, I just want to say, I mean, part of where that comes from is something I didn't understand until I became familiar with the geography of the port. I mean, the way the port action worked, you set up picket lines at the entrances to the various berths. But the road that goes through the port is a public road. It's completely open. You know, they can't post security guards on that road. In fact, I went out there. I was riding my bike around there the night before, and there were guys drag racing on these, you know, these wide open streets, because it was empty on a Sunday night. But the resolution, in very kind of coded language, basically is encouraging the police to do what they didn't do, which is prevent protesters from blocking that main street, from blocking the main roads that feed into the port, which they didn't do. You know, the day of the day of the port action, the police presence was, I mean, they were there and they were frightening, but they didn't actually interfere with our movement in any way. And I think the resolution very clearly, if euphemistically, instructed them to do that.
Changing the subject a bit, the political culture of the Bay Area is for someone living 3,000 miles away, is sometimes hard to understand. But you have a mayor who was, I think, a decade ago in a Marxist-Leninist party, who is now leading crackdowns on radical activists. I mean, how does that figure into how politics of the Occupy sort are practiced in the Bay Area?
Well, I mean, it's certainly anyone who was inclined to think that electoral politics was a dead end has received a certain kind of vindication, at least at this local level. Gene Kwan, I can't tell you how many people I know who were very excited about her being elected, who campaigned actively for her, you know, doing door-to-door sort of things, are just completely at a loss as to what's happened. But I think it also does demonstrate the ways in a city like Oakland, you have a very leftist, very progressive electorate, relatively speaking. And then you have the Chamber of Commerce, and you have the institutions of capital and big business as they operate in the city, who have a lot of heft. I have learned in ways that I never had before. The mayor is not actually nearly as powerful as you might expect her to be. The city administrator has a great deal of power. The city councilors have a great deal of power. And so there's she's not, while I would never exempt her from the criticism I would lay against the city. It is a complicated city bureaucracy that has a lot of people who are not, you know, who are not 10 years ago doing those kinds of marches. Although that said, I mean, one of the interesting things about the port shutdown is that Jerry Brown has marched in to shut down that very port. The city councilor who a couple nights ago put forward a resolution basically to sort of empower the police to use more force in shutting down, to use more force in preventing occupiers from shutting down the port. He has taken part in such actions. I mean, you have a lot of politicians here who have on occasion been involved in relatively radical kinds of activities, progressive causes, who are now just 100% doing everything they can to shut down Occupy as it obtains in Oakland. And so I don't have a full explanation for that. But it certainly will disillusion you, you know, if you think it's enough to get good people into office, because these are, in many cases, these seem to be like, these are sort of the best people we could hope for. And this is how little we've gotten out of someone like Gene Kwan.
Yeah, the folks at the Village Voice used to write about the permanent government in New York, which were basically Wall Street and real estate people. I imagine there's an analogous structure in Oakland, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And how tied are they to people around the region? I mean, it's not just a local elite, right? This is a regional elite for whom the mayor works.
Yeah, I mean, I can't connect all the dots like that, but... you know, but Oakland's history is always connected to the cities around it. I mean, one of the problems that Oakland always runs up against is that just across the border, you know, just outside of Oakland, in Emeryville, in Alameda, in Berkeley, in San Francisco, San Francisco is a different case, but, you know, in Piedmont is this little tiny island of very, very wealthy. It's a very, very wealthy residential city lit that's sort of completely surrounded by Oakland on all sides. And, you know, if you look at a map of Oakland and you sort of look at where most of the big industrial centers are, you can sort of see the way the boundaries of Oakland as a city have been neatly drawn so as to exclude them. You know, and so a lot of the city's financial problems have a lot to do with the fact that it's been economically gerrymandered in a certain way to keep its tax base very low.
And finally, now, what has the effect of eviction been on Occupy Oakland? How is the movement continuing without a home base?
It is very difficult, and this is one of the things that I think. And this is having not seen other non-Bay Area occupations. I'm not sure how it's affected New York or Boston or Philadelphia or wherever. But Occupy Oakland was a remarkable space. Every time I would bring someone there, they would be kind of overwhelmed by the experience of being in this place where an incredible variety of people were eating together, speaking together, you know, doing all sorts of things together. And taking that away makes us all, we all kind of fall back on our own little communities rather than having this one space where you interact with people from just any number of walks of life. You find yourself back in your own. And so I think it's really...
It's building solidarity through like a material practice of daily life.
Exactly. And right now, you know, and it's building solidarity across really tricky political boundaries and really tricky places where people fundamentally disagree. There's a lot of schisms around, you know, between the liberals, the radicals, the militants, the anarchists, different kinds of factions that when you're actually sitting with someone, when you're actually sharing food with someone, you can work your way through those things. When you're communicating with those people sporadically through Twitter, through whatever, it becomes a much more contentious engagement. And so ideological disagreement becomes much more problematic. I think that it's, you know, there's just no question that removing the camp has interrupted Occupy's ability to coordinate centrally. But I think what's happening right now is a lot of autonomous groups, a lot of different action groups are taking this as a kind of opportunity to take what actions they see as necessary. So a lot of things going around foreclosure defense is no longer being routed through the General Assembly. It's no longer happening in that kind of centralized way that the Occupy Oakland would have done it before. And so those things are happening much more quietly and in less coordinated ways. Some would say that's a better thing. The General Assembly is many things, but it's not efficient. So it's I wouldn't call it a mixed blessing exactly, but I think taking away the camp has forced Occupy to figure out new tactics, and people are doing that.
All right, thanks, Aaron. That was Aaron Beatty, a Berkeley grad student who blogs under the name Zungu Zungu. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Merry holidays to you all. Let's go out with this, some of Bustin' Out from Nona Hendrix and Material from 1982. Till next week, bye.